We move on to the next case of the morning, which is St. Paul Travelers versus Corn Island Shipyard. Mr. Hahn.
Thank you, Judge. This case, as you know, arises from a declaratory judgment action that St. Paul Travelers filed against Corn Island. It concerns an umbrella policy issued by St. Paul with effective dates of coverage, as you know. And the issue is whether a compensable claim under the Longshore Harbors Workers Act involving a Corn Island employee is covered under the St. Paul policy. This policy is known as a bumper chute policy, which I believe is an English term meaning umbrella.
You believe correctly. That's what it means.
Okay. The twist to this dispute is that the workers' comp carrier for Corn Island was forced into liquidation after it had paid over $1 million in benefits. This carrier was named Fremont Industrial Indemnity Company. It went into liquidation in June of 2003 in proceedings in California. This appeal before this court comes upon the decision of the district court, which entered summary judgment in favor of St. Paul against Corn Island. The district court, by his decision, applied New York law on late notice and determined that the claim of Corn Island was untimely. It was too late.
Does it swing entirely, the case swing entirely on choice of law?
According to Judge Hamilton, that's correct.
No, I'm asking according to you. Does it swing entirely on the question of?
Yes.
Okay.
And so
you don't dispute Judge Hamilton's?
I think that's the first question the court's going to have to ask,
yeah,
is what law applies.
Yeah.
And Judge Hamilton, of course, did not address the merits of the case, whether a coverage existed. He determined that there was no coverage.
Well, the merits aren't before us either. The only thing before us is a question of the choice of law and whether or not timely. That requires that they say it was untimely. He was correct in that analysis.
Right.
Am I correct in my analysis of what we're facing?
Well, as we presented it to the court, we presented it, yes, that Judge Hamilton was incorrect, implying New York law, and then we've asked for the court to, on its own, find that there is coverage on the policy as a matter of law.
So if the choice of law that he selected was incorrect, you're entitled to a judgment from this court as a matter of law.
That's what we were asking.
That's what you're saying.
Yes. And we believe the court was incorrect in applying New York law. We believe that the Longshore Harbors Act prevents insurance companies from raising this type of defense. We believe the language of the Act is clear. There are two sections involved in the Act, 935 and 936. Both policies specifically provide that policies issued under authority of the Act must contain certain provisions. One of the required provisions is that notice to the employer constitutes notice to the carrier. Therefore, when Corn Island received notice of this, that constituted notice to the carrier. We believe this reading of the Act is consistent with how courts treat this Act. It's a remedial Act, and courts provide it with a liberal interpretation.
I don't understand your argument in that regard to be a choice of law argument. Getting back to Judge Bauer's questions, your argument is basically
that the federal statute
trumps.
That's correct. That is our argument.
So you agree then that New York law governs, but the federal statute controls?
We agree that certain provisions of the policy certainly are controlled by New York law, as the policy provides. But the Act provides and requires that policies issued under this Act, under the authority of the Act, must contain certain provisions. Therefore, a provision in the policy which counters that can't be enforceable.
Well, that raises a threshold question about whether the St. Paul policy, as an excess policy, not a workers' compensation policy, really is a policy that's covered by the federal statute.
That's correct. And we believe that it is. Number one,
it doesn't look like one. It doesn't read like one. It doesn't provide coverages like one.
Well, it does contain a schedule which on its face shows that there is coverage.
Are excess policies typically issued in workers' compensation situations? It seems to me there's a real disconnect here. Yeah. As a matter, just a fundamental matter of insurance law. Excess policies are not issued for workers' compensation.
Typically not, but this is an unusual policy. It's not a standard policy. The language is pretty unique to it.
The umbrella policy is not the usual policy. Is that what you said?
This is not a standard policy. It's a very unusual policy how it reads.
This is not an insurance industry form policy.
I don't believe it is. I think it's very unique in how it's drafted.
What do you base that on? We're not going to find this policy or something like it in standard insurance manuals.
I don't think you'll find it in a standard manual. Normally the policies that you see are very standard and they follow specific forms.
Right. Drafted
this one
by
doesn't.
The industry.
This one doesn't follow a particular form.
The Fremont policy had as workers' comp, right?
No question.
But it also had another section that talked about, injury liability or something, did it not? And that was $500,000?
Yes.
Yeah. The way I look at it, for instance, if the employer here had a, Corn Island has a truck driver who's driving on the job, and he runs a stoplight and injures someone, and he's injured himself, the person he injured is subject to a lawsuit against the company or has a lawsuit against the company. The driver who was injured is confined to workers' comp, which is, of course, it's strict liability, and there's no issue about whether or not he ran the stop sign. That distinction seems to be what was insured. The person he ran into sued the company, and the insurance applies. I assume that Fremont's kicks in, or whatever extent, and then the umbrella takes over on that claim. I don't see where the umbrella could even come in under workers' comp. And obviously the company went bankrupt, spending a whole lot more than $500,000 on this person's injuries.
The twist to this is that this schedule, which is part of the St. Paul policy, expressly provides, it includes the insuring agreement, the schedules, the endorsements. The schedule which was attached to this policy lists the Fremont policy and identifies the covered risks of Longshore Harbor's workers, workers' compensation, and employer's liability with limits of $500,000. That's in the schedule.
And that implies at least that it's an umbrella over all of that? What's the limit on workers' comp, for example?
I think the limits on workers' comp is based on the state statute or, in this case, a federal statute.
But there is no insurance coverage limit for workers' compensation. That's limitless, isn't it?
That would be limitless.
So in that sense, there's nothing for this excess policy to cover if the underlying insurance covers everything.
Except if you look at the insuring agreement provides coverage where under 2A of the insuring agreement, it provides that Corn Island shall be liable for amounts in excess of the limits identified in the schedule. And then part B, which is an alternative theory that we've raised, is that coverage will be provided in excess of $25,000 of the net ultimate loss not covered by said underlying limits.
But that doesn't address the point that I just made. If there are no said underlying limits, then there's nothing for this excess policy to cover. And you've conceded that the workers' compensation insurance has no limits.
In that situation, doesn't 2B kick in?
Well, I'm asking you to explain your position in light of my question.
To me, if it's not covered by said underlying limits, then 2B would kick in.
But my point is that there are no underlying limits in the Fremont policy. Workers' compensation insurance doesn't have any limits. It just covers the claim.
Right.
In its entirety. So there's nothing for this excess policy to cover when you're talking about workers' compensation insurance as the underlying policy.
I understand where you're coming from.
Okay.
What's the outstanding claim now? Obviously, a lot of money has been spent on this person. Is the person cured, or is there...
This person sustained severe burns. I believe 65% of his body was burnt.
Right. I mean, we've got over $1 million in medicals. But the question is he stable, or is he an invalid somewhere where someone has to have a constant care?
He has ongoing care. I believe he's required to take a lot of pain medications to keep him at a certain level. I think he requires nursing care.
So it's an expensive...
It's an expensive...
Long-term.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, so somebody, obviously, looking for a deep pocket for somebody, and maybe Corn Island isn't that deep pocket, and obviously, because they sort of imply that this was sort of a last resort, running over to the umbrella after 5 or 7 months after you were notified that Corn Island's going to be responsible for this.
Right. That's correct.
Well, that saves some time for rebuttal. You're into it.
I'm sorry?
I see you're into your rebuttal
time. Oh, I'm sorry. I'll reserve my time. Thank you.
You can do with it whatever you wish.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Carbon?
May it please the Court, good morning. James Carbon from the firm Duane Morris on behalf of the appellee, St. Paul Fire Marine Insurance Company. Corn Island asked this court to do what it itself did not do, which is treat St. Paul as its longshore harbor workers' compensation carrier. Let me note at the outset that Corn Island does not contest that its notice to St. Paul was late. They'd never made that argument. What Corn Island did do prior to Mr. Williams' injury was consistent with the Longshore Harbor Workers' Compensation Act. Excuse me. That act requires that an employer such as Corn Island secure insurance to protect against its potential obligation to pay benefits to an injured employee. Corn Island did that. They got insurance with Fremont Insurance Company. And for the several years preceding Mr. Williams' injury, consistent with the act, they identified Fremont as its longshore harbor compensation insurer. When Mr. Williams was injured, they did not report to St. Paul. They did report the injury to its insurer, Fremont. During the period that Mr. Williams' claim was being administered by the Department of Labor, they did not identify St. Paul. They identified Fremont, their longshore harbor workers' compensation insurer. Indeed, it was not until, as Your Honor has observed, 7 months after Fremont became insolvent and Corn Island was looking about for where it can park this loss because they no longer had Fremont available, did they first notify St. Paul. That, of course, was after Fremont had paid out close to $1.1 million towards this claim, well in excess of the supposed $500,000 limit that Corn Island now contends was the Fremont limitation. Your Honor correctly asked what the limit in the Fremont Longshore Harbor Workers' Compensation Insurance is. That policy has an inherent limit. When you read the policy, Part A, and look at Clause 6 in the insurance terms of that policy, it states, we will pay the benefits awarded. So whatever the benefits are that are awarded is what the Fremont policy is obligated to pay without a dollar limit. I say it's an inherent limit because the limit corresponds to whatever the schedule of benefits are under the federal statute.
Now, those are disability benefits and stuff. As far as medical, is there a limit?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe it is unlimited under the federal statute, and obviously the medical care afforded is consistent with whatever is needed. Again, that's something that Fremont picks up in its entirety under its own policy. And I point to Clause 6 in the insurance terms and conditions of the Fremont policy. Your Honor also asked about the employee's liability, the Section 2 cover in the Fremont policy. And let me explain exactly what that is, and then I'd like to draw the Court's attention to the policy itself. As noted, New York law, and you heard counsel recognize that New York law is plainly provided for in the St. Paul policy, and New York law is the governing law in terms of interpreting and understanding the policy. New York law makes clear that when you look at an insurance policy, the Jefferson Pilot case in the Court of Appeals, citing the Graphic Mutual case, its own earlier decision, makes clear that when you look at a policy, look at the purpose of that policy in the context in which it was written. When you have a number of policies put together, as these two policies were, as part of a program, you look at them in that context. Typically what happens in a liability insurance scenario, Your Honor, is that an insured such as Corn Island would have a CGL, Comprehensive General Liability Policy. Those policies, as a matter of standard, exclude any liability to an employee for an injury on the job. It's called the employee exclusion. As a result of that, or the reason it's excluded is because the employee gets the benefit of the workman's comp statute, and that is secured by a workman's comp policy. In addition, when an employee is injured, such as in the scenario Your Honor described, where he may be in a vehicle accident off premises, and he's injured on the job, he does not have a cause of action against his employer. He may, however, sue that other driver. The other driver then could implead the employer as the owner of the vehicle and or on a respondent superior basis being responsible for the employee's negligence. The employer's liability section of all workman's compensation policies, including the Fremont policy, picks up that impleader liability that arises out of an employee's negligence and an employee's injury. Thus, the workman's comp policy...
When you say employee's negligence and employee's injury?
It picks up the employee's injury on the benefits side, and it picks up...
Benefits side meaning workers' comp.
Correct.
Yeah.
And it picks up the...
liability, injury to the other person.
It may pick up the liability by virtue of an impleader scenario, and that's the purpose of the employee's liability, Part 2, of the workman's comp policy, and that is a standard policy. The same scenario exists under the Longshore Harbor Workers' Compensation Act, where you may have a benefits exposure and also an exposure for employees' negligence that results in a third-party action against the insured employer. If I may ask the panel to look at the policy itself, and I draw your attention to the bumper sheet policy first, and the schedule we've heard so much about.
What are you looking at? I don't know why I had that here or not.
Yes. It's the separate appendix of the appellant, Corn Island, Your Honor, and I draw your attention to page 19. And this is the schedule that we've heard discussed so much. If we look at it, there is a Marine General Liability Policy identified at the top. That would be the equivalent of the Comprehensive General Liability Policy that we spoke about that would exclude any liability to an employee arising out of an employee negligence. The last policy listed is the Fremont Workman's Compensation Employee's Liability Policy. When you look to the right, we see the limits for the employee's liability section of that policy. And I raise that so that Your Honor can compare how that corresponds to the exact limit in the Fremont policy. And if you turn to page 36 in the same appendix, you'll see that page 36 is the a page in a workers' compensation employee's liability cover. Page 6 is captioned Employee's Liability Insurance. And under that, it sets forth the limits both for Indiana comp and USL&H comp. And it has the same three limits that we see on the schedule for employee's liability: bodily injury by accident, bodily injury by disease, bodily injury by disease policy limit in aggregate, 500, 500, 500, which is the exact entry we see on the schedule of underlying insurance. What it tells us is that the schedule is referencing the employee's liability exposure in the Fremont policy, and it is that employee's liability exposure that the Bumbershoot is excess of. It is not excess of, and indeed cannot be excess of, the Fremont workers' comp policy that does not have a dollar limit for its obligation to pay benefits to an employee who has been injured. I'd also like to address counsel's comments about Section 2B of the Bumbershoot policy and a suggestion that that somehow picks up the cover when Fremont becomes insolvent. Unfortunately, the case law disagrees with the argument entirely. And when we look at the Permco case, the Pergamon case, and even one of the cases cited by Cornell itself, the Garamendi case, the 1986 11th Circuit, each of those cases construes this same clause. And what the cases say is that the purpose of that clause is not to pick up an insolvent insurer, but rather is to pick up the odd claim that is not covered by any insurance anywhere. Here we have a claim that was covered by Fremont. They paid $1.1 million before they became insolvent. There is no suggestion that this claim was not covered anywhere. In fact, in the Garamendi case relied upon by Corn Island, the court there cites Appleman on Insurance, a well-known insurance treatise. And Appleman explains the purpose of that clause 2A, which is to cover the odd claim that might fall between conventional insurance coverage. And I can give Your Honor an example of that. Several years ago, I looked at a file that involved a workman's comp claim by an employer of a Houston-based company, by an employee of a Houston-based employer, who was situated in Nigeria. And while he was working in Nigeria, he became injured. He put a claim into the company. The company filed a claim with this workman compensation insurer. However, the workman's compensation policy did not have worldwide operations coverage. Most workers' compensation policies, as we see here with Fremont, are issued either on a state basis or multiple states where the employer operates. They had no coverage for this employee who was situated and working overseas. That was the type of claim, and when you look at Appleman on Insurance, this is the type of worldwide operation he addresses as a scenario where the Part 2B would respond to. That was the type of claim where the Bumbershoot would pick up this odd claim that fell in between all the other coverages that were in place and respond for it. It does not respond for a claim that indeed is covered by one of the insurances the employer or insured has. And as I said, Fremont obviously did cover this claim. They paid $1.1 million. The only reason we are here today is because Fremont went insolvent. And what those cases equally say, what Appleman equally points out, is the very notion of an excess policy is that it is excess. It is not intended to guarantee the risk of an insolvent primary insurer. That is precisely what Cohen Island asked this court to rule. And I submit to you that's error.
You all done?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thanks. Mr. Hahn? Which time you got left? You got 3 minutes.
With regard to the designation of St. Paul, I think counsel is that argument is the argument that perhaps this policy does not fall within the contours or the act itself. We believe that the policy covers carriers who are authorized to issue policies. It doesn't deal with who's designated who as before the Department of Labor. It deals with who's authorized. The regulations are very specific on carriers who are authorized to provide coverage. the statute itself says policies issued under authority of this act shall do such and such, meaning that they should have certain provisions, those provisions dealing with notice. It doesn't talk about designation. So those carriers who are authorized. To be authorized, the regulations provide that the carrier must submit an application, such and such and such, and then once they receive authority, they are given certificates of authority, and that with that certificate of authority, then they are issued the right to underwrite policies of insurance. St. Paul has never claimed in this case that it did not have authority to write a policy under this act.
But the question is whether it did in this instance.
That is the question, and we believe it did. We believe on the face. They're the ones who drafted the policy. They did provide a schedule which lists this particular item as a covered risk. The schedule identifies three policies that we had with regard to that schedule. It deals with specific covered risks, and it identifies what risks are covered under that specific umbrella policy. This policy was named. The risks were named. Longshore Harbors was named. We believe there was coverage.
When does it kick in?
Coverage would have kicked in That's a good point.
That's the problem.
I would say coverage kicked in when...
And it went bankrupt.
Perhaps when it went bankrupt.
And so you're basically saying the umbrella insures the an insolvent area.
And there are cases, Judge, that do say that type of risk can be covered depending on the policy language.
Okay.
And here we do have a policy that provides that there is specific coverage for this. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. And thanks to both counsel. This case will be taken under advisement.